This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
Dr. Tom DiLorenzo is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute. He's the author or co-author of 13 books. He's professor of economics at Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. And I want to talk to him today about his latest book, which is called Hamilton's Curse. Tom, certainly throughout American history, there have been famously these two sides battling, the Jeffersonian and the Hamiltonian. A lot of terrible institutions like the Federal Reserve see Hamilton as their godfather, and he really was the godfather of so much wrong in current-day America, wasn't he?
He certainly was, Lou. The subtitle of my book is How Jefferson's Archenemy Subverted the American Revolution and What It Means for Americans Today. And from the time of the founding of America, there always was a group of men, including Hamilton, who essentially wanted to bring the British mercantilist system to America. They wanted America to become an empire like the British Empire, and they wanted the economic policy to be an interventionist, mercantilist policy with protectionism, a central bank like the Bank of England, and what we today call corporate welfare. And the Jeffersonians were onto this, men like Jefferson himself and Senator John Taylor, especially another Virginian. They looked at what Hamilton was saying and said, we just fought a revolution against this kind of government. Why would we want to impose this on ourselves? And my take on it is that Hamilton, like the other founders, knew that if you're on the paying side of a mercantilist empire, it's not a good thing. It was worth fighting a revolution over. But if you're on the collecting side, it's not a bad deal. It's a good route to money and power. And so the big battle between Jefferson and Hamilton was all over that. It was all over, would the government be one that would just protect life, liberty, and property? Or would it pursue what Hamilton called imperial glory and empire and the attempt to become wealthy through mercantilism, which at the time Adam Smith had pretty well smashed that idea. But Hamilton was not much of an economist. The great William Graham Sumner, the libertarian social scientist of the late 19th, early 20th century, wrote a biography of Hamilton, and he said he was, quote, befogged in the mists of mercantilism on his, with regard to his economic ideas.
And wasn't he an advocate as well of the imperial presidency?
He was. He lobbied for a constitutional convention for 7 years because he was unhappy with the Articles of Confederation. Patrick Henry responded to him by saying, well, you know, the Articles of Confederation produced a government big enough to defeat the British Empire. Isn't that sufficient? When Hamilton got to the convention, he laid out his plan, which was for a permanent president who would appoint all the governors and who would have veto power over all state legislation. So in other words, a king. And the Jeffersonians called it a king. They said he wants a king. And of course, that failed. That plan failed. And he also wanted just about all power centralized in the nation's capital. So, and that eventually is what we've ended up with. That's what my book is about. It's about the evolution of American history, of how we got to this point where Hamilton's Republic, as it is called by his admirers, actually exists. We have a powerful executive like a king, only even more powerful than a king. Our presidents think of themselves more or less as emperors of the world. And Hamilton would have been very happy of that. And the Jeffersonians fought him and his followers tooth and nail for many decades, but they lost. And I tell that story in my book, Hamilton's Curse.
Why did they lose?
Well, the war between the states was the first victory for the Hamiltonians. In fact, I quote several historians as using the phrase Hamiltonian hegemony to describe the post-1865 era, where the historians recognize that the war between the states really was the breaking point, where this debate took place at the ballot box and in the courts and in the arena of public opinion until the 1860s, when there was no longer any arguing, and it was bullets that took the place of ballots and arguments. And the Hamiltonians, which were essentially the North, won that debate by force of arms. And the historians recognize that. And because the things that Hamilton wanted economically, central banking, protectionism, corporate welfare, they were all put into place during the Lincoln regime, and it greatly expanded in the years after that up until 1913 when we got the Fed. I have a chapter in Hamilton's Curse entitled The Hamiltonian Revolution of 1913, when we finally centralize all political power in Washington and destroy the states totally as having any sovereignty, because we had the Fed, the income tax, and the 17th Amendment all in that 1 year. And the 17th Amendment called for the direct election of senators as opposed to their being appointed by state legislatures as they had been.
So in some sense, we can blame George W. Bush on Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, the Republican Party, I quote Newt Gingrich in my book, after the Republicans took over Congress in 94, Time magazine interviewed Gingrich and asked him who his heroes were. And hero number one was Alexander Hamilton, followed by Kemal Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkish Republic, Father Flanagan, and John Wayne. And but he put Alexander Hamilton first, and so the Hamiltonian wing of the Republican Party has totally dominated. We call them neocons today.
I suppose it's not a coincidence that Kemal Ataturk was a dictator.
Well, yeah, the neocons love the idea of dictator as long as they can be in charge of the dictatorship. And it's not an. I also quote William Crystal and David Brooks when they began their crusade for what they called national greatness conservatism. It was a 1997 Wall Street Journal article in which they said, we need to do something really, really big now that the Cold War is over, like build a tunnel under the Atlantic Ocean to England or something like that. And they said, I quote them as saying, we need to return to the policies of Hamilton and Teddy Roosevelt. And they put Teddy Roosevelt in the Hamiltonian tradition, and that tradition, of course, is on display today in Iraq.
You know, Hamilton, the first neocon, it's a great way to think of him.
Yeah, I quote a historian who, there's a historian who wrote a whole book on Hamilton's foreign policy, and the title of the book is The American Machiavelli. So he was, and Jefferson himself, in a letter to James Madison, called Hamilton a political colossus. He was a brilliant man, very high IQ. He was a workaholic, and he was a relentless statist. He was constantly badgering George Washington, telling him we need a government of more energy. And he led an army of 13,000 men, by the way, conscripts, to put down the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania. The officers who accompanied Hamilton were not conscripts. They were mostly men from the Eastern Seaboard who were government bondholders, and they wanted to make sure that the Treasury had enough money to pay off their bonds. And they rounded up 20 hapless tax protesters, marched them clear across the state of Pennsylvania, put them on trial. Hamilton wanted to hang all of them. George Washington pardoned everyone, and Hamilton was very unhappy about that. And he championed a standing army. And this episode, the Whiskey Rebellion, showed me why Hamilton championed a standing army, which Jefferson did not. He wanted a standing army of tax collectors to collect taxes from Americans and to intimidate Americans into paying all the taxes he had in mind for them. He wasn't really worried about the French invading or anything like that. And of course, we have that standing army of tax collectors. It's called the IRS.
And as Murray Rothbard pointed out, in western Pennsylvania, there wasn't much specie in circulation, and people used liquor as money.
Right, they were wheat farmers and grain farmers, and it was too cumbersome to haul all that grain and wheat across the mountains of Pennsylvania to Philadelphia to sell. But if they distilled it into whiskey, and it was easier, apparently, to transport and sell whiskey. And so they felt they were being discriminated against because there was a special tax, which Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, had put on whiskey. But they asked, well, why is there no special tax on tobacco or cotton or rice or anything else? Why us? And they tarred and feathered tax collectors when they showed up, federal tax collectors. And it was a real, sometimes violent tax protest. And George Washington and Alexander Hamilton rode up there to western Pennsylvania to try to put it down. But the end result was the tax protesters won. The whiskey tax was not collected. And when Jefferson was elected president, he abolished the whiskey tax. Most historians get it wrong. They say this was a good example of the federal government proving it had the power to tax whenever it wanted and in whatever kind it wanted. But it didn't. It lost the Whiskey Tax Rebellion.
Tom, with your two books on Lincoln, The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked, you've pretty much broken apart the clay feet of the Lincoln Colossus. So this new book of yours, Hamilton's Curse, may it have the same effect on this evil founding father. I want to direct everyone to Tom DiLorenzo's archive on LouRockwell.com. A lot of unbelievably fascinating and informative and beautifully written articles. At the bottom of each of them, you'll see links to Tom's books. You can pre-order Hamilton's Curse. You can order The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked. Do yourself a favor. learn something about the real American history and read Tom DiLorenzo. Tom, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Lou.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@LouRockwell.com. And thanks for listening.